Hello, welcome to Farmgate. I'm Finlow Castain. Western civilization has, for generations, sought to extract itself from its dependence on the natural world. Indigenous knowledge has been devalued and lost, and instead we've extracted nature's riches and given little consideration to the consequences. Our cities have expanded, our economies have grown, and in many ways our lives have been enriched. But the external costs have built up exponentially, and now the ecological deficit is profound. Even now, as our monumental folly becomes clearer with each passing day, those who lead us have little real conception of our innate dependency upon an interconnected natural world, and without that, there is little hope that they will be able to deliver the strategies of regeneration required to arrest humanity's collapse. Storytelling is a critical means of communicating different paths and informing societal change, and Judith D. Schwartz has collected evidence of landscape-scale recovery, led on the ground by visionaries who have reconnected themselves with nature, who have learned from listening to the heartbeat of their ecosystems, and who have transformed deserts into fertile ground. Judith is the author of Cows Save the Planet and Water in Plain Sight, and today we're discussing her latest book, The Reindeer Chronicles. Judy, welcome.
Thank you.
Loads to talk about. If you don't mind, I'd like to get straight into the mossy tundra. What can we learn from reindeer?
Yeah, so the lesson that reindeer are trying to tell us is the way that organisms in nature create the conditions under which they thrive. So in the behavior of the reindeer is a strategy for maintaining the land that they live on. So we can look at that in their summer grazing. So in their summer grazing, they are nibbling at leaves, and that is keeping down the shrubs so that the heather dominates, and that's lighter. It has a higher albedo. It's more reflective, so it keeps that landscape cool. It also keeps that landscape so that it, you know, wears the snow in a way that is conducive to the reindeer moving in the winter. And that's really important. That sounds kind of like a really small point, but the northern regions, like Scandinavia, Finland, Russia, where the reindeer rain is warming quite rapidly. And what they're seeing is what they call shrubification. So these shrubs are getting more of a toehold in the landscape. I remember when I was visiting Norway, I was really stunned by how I would see familiar trees, but they were smaller. They were in miniature. And that's because it is that much harder for these plants to grow. But with the warming, they're getting more of a chance. So the reindeer are managing those plants to minimize their growth.
So the reindeer are actually managing the biodiversity. They are a keystone species there that are sort of holding back certain elements of nature, allowing other elements of nature to flourish. And they are actually maintaining the tundra in a cooler state where if they don't exist, what do we see? We see warming within the tundra, even sort of accelerated.
Yes, I believe so. There's been research that found that areas in the far north, this is a pair of Russian scientists that manage the project called Pleistocene Park, which is trying to kind of revive the mammoth steppe ecosystem. They found that land that was grazed in the winter actually maintained its coldness by about 15 degrees centigrade. It was that much colder. Now, you know, that sparks question, how can that possibly be? But what happens, and this is what the reindeer do as well as other grazers, you know, like moose and, you know, muskox and all those other creatures. So the reindeer, they press down the snowpack. And that sounds like a negative thing because everyone likes the look of pristine, fluffy snow. I certainly do. It's very skiable. But that presses it down and means that the ground, the soil, is in direct contact with the very cold air. So the snow was acting like an insulator, like a blanket. It was holding in whatever warmth was there. But without it, the permafrost stays more frosty because it's directly exposed to the air.
When we're talking about the reindeer and we're talking about their strategic role keeping the tundra cool, there's no indication that the reindeer are aware of what they're doing, is there? It's just that they have evolved in this particular way and have a particular function within nature overall.
Yes, they evolved in the context of their environment. And so their hooves are shaped a special way so that they can get at the lichen, you know, just, you know, their whole body is in relation to this northern clime.
Now, in your chapter, They Belong to This Land, there's a harrowing account of environmental policies from government that are diametrically in conflict with the ecosystem renewal that we've just been talking about. Tell us what happened there.
Yeah. So when I went to Norway, everybody was talking about this law case. And the government, the Norwegian government, had mandated that all reindeer herders cull their herds by a particular percentage. So if you were a young herder and you hadn't accumulated a lot of animals, that percentage would kind of bring you under the margin of what was viable. So a young herder named Ante Sara Jovset, he was all of 23 years old and he refused. He stood up to the government and he said, I am not going to kill any of my reindeer, because if this policy goes through, that is basically saying that my generation cannot continue the practices of our forebears, because it will be impossible for us to make a living doing the work that we have been trained to do, that we have aspired to do, that we have every intention to do. And he kept winning. He kept winning in the lower courts. The government kept countersuing. And finally, unfortunately, the government prevailed. But what also made this very dramatic is that his sister, Marit Andsara, she is a conceptual artist. So she was creating these artworks, these installations that highlighted the violence that had been done upon the animals and upon the Sami people that they belong to over time. So the international community was reacting to the art, and it became a very big cause. Now, the tragedy here is that, as I indicated earlier, the government was wrong. The government had claimed that the reindeer were harming the fragile tundra ecosystem, but that wasn't true. In fact, the reindeer were maintaining it.
And just to give people a sense of the art that we're talking about, as I remember, it was using skulls and bones from the reindeer that was sort of evocative of those great piles of bison and buffalo skulls that you tend to associate with the Wild West in the USA.
Yes. So the series of installations that she did, she called Pile of Sápmi. Sápmi is the region of Finnmark, the part of Norway that the Sami live in, the area that the reindeers move across the land. It means basically pile of this land, and that evokes the pile of bones, those really harrowing photos that you refer to of, you know, a white man standing on top of a pile of buffalo skulls. So she gathered 200 reindeer skulls and put a Norwegian flag on top of it. So it was quite a strong statement. And then there was another one that was like she made almost jewelry out of reindeer skulls, made a screen. And that apparently was purchased by the National Museum of Norway.
Because it had been such an important installation in its own right, or because of its own innate beauty, do you think?
I don't know. I only see it as a very profound irony.
And I'm interested, you know, when we started talking, you talked about the grace of the reindeer and the way that they move. And we've just been talking about that art installation. And clearly there was a sort of philosophical element to that, a pure art element, but also a political message that was driving it. And I wonder, you know, in your own experience, being out there in the ice on the tundra, watching the reindeer, did that influence you in any way as a writer? Did you feel sort of moved spiritually?
Well, I have to say, I was not up in Finnmark the farthest north that I got was Trondheim, but I did see a lot of the land. An animal manager named Ulf Ulring was my guide, and he took me to many places. He manages a national park near Lillehammer. And it wasn't as much a spiritual sense as a sense of the accumulation of time. He took me for a walk and showed me areas where ancient ruins have been found, ancient evidence of humans and metalwork. And it felt rich in space and rich in temporal space. And the other thing that awed me about the land was just how far north it went. When I came into Trondheim, which is only about one third of the way up into the country, I was stunned by the light. This was in May. There was a sense of light even at around midnight when I landed. And it just dawned on me how incredibly vast these northern landscapes are. So yeah, so it was a spaciousness of land, of light, of time, and of the history of these people and the relationship to the animals.
I just want to go back to the court case and whether you have a sense of the motivation there, because looking at it from the outside, it would be easy to assume that there were lots of different motivations, that some of them might have been ecological, that some of them might have been historical. Do you get the sense that the court case was being brought against the government simply because the Sami herdspeople weren't able to earn a living, that it was about farming, it was the history of farming and being able to carry on with that tradition? Or was there a sense of the importance of the reindeer within the landscape, the importance of it as an ecological keystone?
I think it's all of the above. And in a very basic way, it was about the survival of their culture. As Marit Ahn told me, every aspect of their lives, of their traditions, is centered on the reindeer. The reindeer are their food. They are their clothing, their bank, their meaning, their reason for togetherness. So it was pretty existential. Now, if we're going to talk about the government's goals in culling the reindeer, then things get a little darker, and a cynical side of myself that I don't always like to invite or even let emerge starts cropping up. Because as it turns out, these vast lands of the far north, which in the past had been kind of irrelevant, just all the action is going on down in the cities, down in Oslo, and all the trading and all of the economic life. So, okay, let the Sami people have that land. It's really no bother to us. But that land happens to hold a lot of minerals. It happens to be very strategic geopolitically and economically now. It happens to have oil and gas reserves. So suddenly, there needed to be a reason for the government to have greater command over it. And hydro. Hydro is very big in Norway and has led to a lot of alteration of the landscape. So all of a sudden, okay, we got to get rid of the reindeer. And sure, I'm sure there was some ignorance about the dynamics of the reindeer and the landscape, but it was pretty convenient to have greater access.
This seems to me to be such a supreme example of how our plummeting ecological security is indelibly linked to Western colonialism, that as we stole land from indigenous peoples, we imposed our own worldview on nations and communities who were previously living quite happily in balance with nature, that our science, our need was greater, more important than their knowledge and their culture. Do you get a sense from your travels around the world, is this changing at all?
I hope so. I would say that conversations are changing, that there's more of a desire on the part of many to listen to Indigenous people and to respect and learn from them. However, there is another flavor of colonialism that we're seeing a lot of. And I would say that Scandinavian countries may be the poster child for this, and that is green colonialism. So in the guise of renewable energy, governments and businesses can plunder landscapes to get at rare earth minerals, to get at all that is needed to create so-called renewable energy, including hydropower, which really has left a lot of damaged landscapes in Norway. So green colonialism, I find extremely insidious, because many decisions are made in boardrooms without really looking at land. So there is a combination of ignorance and heedlessness and the notion that sacrifice zones are okay.
That's interesting, because, of course, you know, what you're talking about there is a grand example of that green colonialism that you talk about. But a lot of people working on the land, farmers, will be aware of that, even, you know, just at a very local scale, that there are environmental organizations that think that they know best about what to do with that land. There's government policy. There are academics who are not conspiring together, but who are all working in their own little worlds, thinking that they're right and imposing these ideas rather than doing an enough listening on the ground to the people who have been working that land, either as individuals or as families or as, you know, as Indigenous peoples from time immemorial.
Yeah, I could say that it's happening right here in Vermont, that because of government policies, this is in the U.S., and state policies, there are a lot of incentives for solar. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with solar. You know, solar is more complicated than we'd like to think. But sure, there's absolutely a place and a need for solar. But there are companies that are holding companies of other holding companies. So it's ultimately, you know, you follow the trail, and it could be fossil fuel companies that are investing in solar projects in small towns, like right next to where I live. And they want to put a huge solar array up that would require clearing 45 acres of forest. So that's crazy. You know, then there's another solar company that cleared forest, I think like 5 acres without permission, and they are being fined $5,000, but $5,000 doesn't bring a forest back. And a forest is not just, trees are not just sticks of carbon, and climate itself is bigger than carbon.
Clearly, the importance of the transition from fossil fuels to renewables is, you know, it's fundamental to our ability to move forward as a species. But I'm interested in those examples that you give. I mean, clearly, it is madness to pull down a forest in order to use that area to generate solar energy. But I'm interested in that idea of the investors within the solar farms and their, you know, how far removed they are back to the boardroom. Does it matter where the money comes from, if the project is a good project, if it's not cutting down forest, if it's using land that isn't necessarily that good for anything else? Does it matter if the money is from a corporation rather than a community?
I would say that would depend on, well, I think intentions matter. So I don't know what the situation is in the UK right now, but you know, it's kind of a wild west out there in terms of carbon credits and, you know, this and offsets. And a community member asked a representative of the company straight out, will you use the credits to offset fossil fuel development by the holding, one of, you know, referred to a holding company? And the gentleman answered, that will be a business decision. So I would say that you're less likely to have a project that respects the people and the land if the developers don't have a stake in the land, if they don't know the land, if they don't have incentives, if the greater incentives are to just not listen to the people. And of course, yeah, this has been the story. You know, I'm seeing it right here, but the story for local and Indigenous people all over the world, even when the intentions are benign or they want to help, the outsider coming in, we know better, even in cases of ecosystem restoration. And I think that's something really important to keep in mind.
Thinking further about green colonialism, but going back to Norway, in the book you reference Andy Sambi, who's a Sami and associate professor at the Faculty of Law at the University of Tromsø. Now, he talks about prey cultures and predator cultures. And I take it that this is not only now, but it's a historical sort of context. What do you think he means?
Yeah, his lecture on this was extremely profound. And he was using the fable of the wolf and the lamb and, you know, going back to Aesop. And yeah, he meant that his culture was vulnerable, was a prey culture. And he talked about the canniness of the predator and all the different types of rhetoric that the predator uses in order to impose its will and extract what it wants from the prey culture. Oh, we know what's best for you. Oh, it's only a little bit of the shore that we are going to control, and your little fishing boats, well, you know, they're not modern. You deserve modern boats. So why don't you just let us bring our big ships in? That kind of thing. Yeah, it was quite a talk that this is something he clearly has thought about for a long time. And just another thing about Sombi is that he's a really brilliant scholar. I could tell, you know, from his talk and everything that he's doing, very well respected. And he's also an artist. He is a singer of joik, which is a tradition of singing. And my guess, and I'd be happy to have a conversation with him about this, is that that is a kind of an art form of resistance of the prey culture, that you can't take our voice away from us.
And when you're talking about the prey culture there, and you're talking or reminding us of that Aesop's fable of the wolf and the lamb, the wolf here that we're talking about, the violence that we're talking about, I guess historically and possibly today, it's actual physical violence. But it's also the sense of a group of indigenous people being disposable in some way of the violence of policy, of government policy.
Yes, that's what it is. And now there is that added piece about that land being of value in ways for reasons that hadn't been anticipated.
Now, in the same chapter, you also write about the Australian donkeys who are moving from one continent to the other side of the world. And the donkey in Australia is a non-Indigenous animal that now arguably plays a vital role in regenerating arid Australian ecosystems. Why does the Australian government see the donkeys as a threat? And why is it that you think they're wrong?
Yeah. So in Australia, in several states of Australia, and we're talking about Western Australia, which is a vast landscape that runs from Perth on the coast and all the way inland. So it's a kind of arbitrary decision. I mean, I'm not saying that invasive species are not a problem, but I think that we need to look at context. So the Australian government has determined, or the Western Australian government has determined, that donkeys are pests and therefore must be eradicated. And what scholars have, they've posed the question, who decides what is native? Because species have been moving across the planet for as long as they've existed. Just like humans are among those species that move across the planet and have done so throughout history. So who determines at what point, like, okay, this is the date that all of the species that are in Australia are native, and all the ones that come after that are not native. So in Australia, it tends to be what author Emma Maris has called the white dude moment, you know, the time that, you know, that Westerners showed up and they saw the kangaroos and they saw the wombat and a bunch of other nifty creatures. And they said, okay, this is Australia's wildlife, and anything else that comes in after, no.
And it's worth noting within that, of course, the donkeys came across at the same time as the Westerners, but it's the donkeys that we're now concerned about and not the Westerners.
That's true. Donkeys were brought over as pack animals. And then when mechanized transport came in, they didn't need the donkeys anymore. So the donkeys were set free. And donkeys live a long time, upwards of 40 years frequently. And so these donkeys were roaming around and they were forming bands and enjoying the vegetation and making a home on the landscape. So there's a really interesting biologist named Arian Walla, and she has been writing about invisible megafauna. Okay. So scientists study animals. And in Australia, they're going to study the kangaroo. They're going to study the wombat and the koala because that's what's there. And they don't notice the donkey except as a problem. But what she points out is that species like donkeys are filling an ecological niche that had been void since the end of the late Pleistocene. So about 40 to 50,000 years ago, Australia lost all of its large megafauna. So, you know, if you look this up, it's extraordinary. There was this huge, this menagerie of animals that would be kind like giant marsupials, like the diprotodon, that would be kind of like, they're kind of the size of an elephant. So they kind of would have a similar ecological role, which is a very important ecological role of cycling vegetation, cycling moisture and carbon and nutrients, moving seeds from place to place, having an impact on the land that creates habitat for other communities, insects and dung beetles and the like. So since losing all the megafauna, the soil, actually, I'm not 100% sure that this is why, but we know that Australia has very thin soil. So that could be a function of the loss of the megafauna. So what Wallach and her colleagues have found out is that the donkeys perform many functions. One of them is that they dig wells so that water pools, and they get at the water and the water pools, and that provides water for other landscapes, for other animals, other wildlife. And then they also kind of tussle up the leaf matter, and that apparently is a very good habitat for small marsupials that aren't doing so well. So that is in general, but there's a specific instance that brought my attention to the donkeys, and I can explain that. So there's a really interesting farmer who I've written about. His name is Chris Hengler, and he manages a tract of land in Western Australia that is the size of Singapore. It is called Kachana Station. Hengler is from Zimbabwe. It was then Rhodesia. And in one of the indigenous languages, Kachana means very, very far. And indeed it is. You can only get there via helicopter. So anyway, they've been managing their land primarily to restore it. Their product is regenerated land. And Chris asked the question, okay, we have three children. Do we want to raise them? And, you know, is our gift to them the tools to compete in an ever-dwindling capitalist, you know, the resources of a capitalist society? Or do we want to create more abundance? And so they chose to create more abundance. So they've been managing the land using cattle. And one of their goals is the reduced intensity and frequency of fire, because it's a very fire-prone landscape. So anyway, they're, you know, the Henglers are doing their thing. They're moving their cattle. They're getting wonderful results, holding moisture, getting increased green growth across the landscape, which is healing the watersheds, and they're minimizing the fires. Of course, they do get fires, but they're keeping them more under control. And then Hengler and his father noticed that there were donkeys. And as they observed the donkeys, they saw that the donkeys were going into areas like further up into a river catchment that the cattle wouldn't go to, and that the donkeys were browsing more than the cattle, which were primarily grazing. I mean, of course, they both do both of those, but so they were having a different impact. Of course, their hooves are different shape and structure. And so they realized that the donkeys could be part of their fire crew. So they actually learned how to herd the donkeys via helicopter and have them move to places where they wanted to go, them to go. So this is all great that they've got a vastly expanded fire crew, but the government says that they should kill their donkeys. Anyway, so this is it's been a kind of standoff for years now. And Hengler is doing his best to try to educate the government officials, but government officials have their job to do. They don't want to take the time. So this is what's going on. It's still a standoff. The hearings have been every year, every half year. They just keep going. But I'm very, very interested because and very concerned because these are wonderful, intelligent animals. And, you know, I mean, the name of the chapter is They Belong to This Land. And that is a quote from an indigenous Australian saying, they're here now. They belong to this land. They are part of our community.
Thank you for that. I'm really struck by that term, invisible megafauna, because when we think of wildlife, when we tend to think of those ecosystem engineers, we tend to think of the big wild animals. Certainly in the UK, we talk a lot about the beaver and we talk about the wolf, but we don't necessarily think of the cow. And of course, the cow is an ecosystem engineer. We're going to talk about the cow a little bit in due course. But it is, to all intents and purposes, for many people, an invisible megafauna because it is managed by people rather than being wild. And I find that really interesting, that disconnect that people have. I want to move on and I want to talk about water. And this year's floods have, of course, been devastating, not only in Libya, where at least 11,000 people have lost their lives, but in India and Hong Kong, in Oman and Guatemala, there's been human misery encircling the earth. Were these, in your view, as insurance companies like to call them, acts of God, or were they the preventable result of a human thirst for economic growth?
I would say both. We know that floods and droughts have always happened. Although I can quote Alan Savory, who developed holistic management, which is the management of livestock as a vehicle for large-scale land restoration, he says that all floods are man-made. And I think one can make a case for that, that in a functioning ecosystem with functioning water cycle, the water is held in the land and then, depending on the particular ecology, would seep into the river, the streams, which would flow into the rivers, which ultimately would flow cleanly into the oceans. But we have created a situation where very little water is held in the land. Much of this is by design, because our cities are designed to sluice water away, to get rid of water as soon as we can. And of course, there's a very good reason for that, and that is so that water doesn't linger and become a source of disease. But there are other ways to manage water. And so that, when I mentioned cities, so that's the built environment. So when the water falls on a roof, for example, that water then, you know, is diverted and isn't, you know, doesn't necessarily go into the soil. Also, so there's the extent that we've paved over our landscape to an extraordinary degree, and that is increasing all the time. Plus, degraded land does not hold water. Desertified land doesn't hold water. So we're not holding on to water, so that when we get floods, there is at least a degree of our management of water that has contributed to the situation.
So there's a sort of a nature element and a nurture element. And I'm struck as you talk that, you know, flooding presumably has always existed and has a role within nature, just as fire exists within nature. And there are, you know, there are key biodiversity species that rely on fire taking place in order for them to flourish. And I presume that there are similar species when it comes to flooding, but there is this way that humankind has nurtured the environment, as you say. say, has paved over environments, has degraded the land so that there isn't that water holding capacity. And so the impact of humankind has been to accelerate the extent of the flooding and the amount of flooding that takes place. And I guess from floods, let's move to deserts. We tend to think of these as dramatic natural features. And I wonder, in the same context, do you see them as that, as phenomenons of nature? Or again, are they the result of human failure?
Again, the answer is both. There are natural deserts, but there are also places that we think of as deserts that in the not too distant past were thriving landscapes with, for example, in the American Southwest, with, you know, thigh-high grasses. But because of our management and tons of animals moving across the landscape, but because of our management, are desiccated. You know, there's some life there, and, you know, a lot of these landscapes are very barren. And we tend to look at land and think it's always been that way. So I think there is a kind of failure of human memory that way. And it's worth looking back and posing the question, what does this land want to be? So, for example, Los Angeles, I mean, not that LA is a desert, but, you know, it was wetlands, you know, that's been paved over and built over. And in terms of desert specifically, if you look historically, I mean, we have to go several thousand years ago, but the Sahara Desert had lots of plant life and lots of animals, including hippos. Now, there's a big scientific debate of, is that the result of the change of the angle of the earth, you know, that there was some, you know, some shift that occurred. But also, we know that humans have tended to desertify landscapes. They've tended to cut down trees and farm without necessarily, you know, taking from the land without necessarily giving back to the land. And over time, that leads to desertification, which is diminished or absent capacity to sustain life on a landscape. And again, we think, we look at those kind of, you know, sad looking landscapes, that they've always been that way, but not at all. We also look at that as a result of climate change, but I think it's really important that we look at desertification as also a cause of climate change, because that land is emitting or certainly not absorbing carbon the way that land where there's actively photosynthesizing plants would. Plus, sunlight is heating up the land, creating hot spots. It's that heat then is re-radiating, as opposed to when land is covered with plants, you get transpiration. The small water cycle is dispersing the heat by, you know, the plants cycling the moisture. So I just think that's really important and something that often gets lost.
And I'm struck when you're talking about the poles there and the way that the Earth may have moved a little at different times and has an impact, that there was an academic study that came out recently that we've reported on 8.9.com about the amount of groundwater that has now been extracted by human beings, and that extraction has actually now resulted in a very slight but a measurable change in the position of the Earth's poles. Now, I wonder if we could just think about the regeneration of the landscapes that we've been talking about. And I wonder if you have a view how quickly it's possible to regenerate landscapes so that they do cycle water properly through healthy ecosystems.
Well, it depends, again, on the context, but it's actually extraordinary how quickly things can shift. I mean, I think about some extreme cases. So there's a rancher that I visited and I've written about in the Chihuahuan Desert grasslands, and the land was very degraded. And within about 5 years, I mean, it shifted really, really rapidly. And the productivity of the land and the, you know, the amount of biodiversity is just extraordinary. You know, you create the conditions and the bio, you know, the birds, the insects, the creatures, everyone comes back. And, Yeah. So that was an example. And then even in a really extreme place like Western Saudi Arabia, a real dry, like hyper desert, hyper arid landscape, someone named Neil Spackman worked to on planting and to grow trees and to grow other plants and to restore the landscape. Within about, I think, 5 years, things started to grow. But if you look at pictures 9 years after that project, you would never guess, you know, with the abundant grasses, you would never guess that this was a desert. I'll just tell you two things about that landscape. So one is that they did not use groundwater. They kept within the budget, their water budget. They only used the water that they caught when it rained. Okay, so that's one thing, you know, because you're talking about groundwater extraction, and that's a real factor in Saudi Arabia. You know, I mean, for a while they were even exporting wheat, you know, which is crazy, using groundwater irrigation to do that. The other thing is that in 2016, after the project had been going on for about 5 years, they ran out of funding. So they had to stop the irrigation. And Neil's response was, well, the permaculture ideal is to have a self-sustaining system. So we're going to see whether indeed we have created that. And he came back 3 years later. And we're talking about a period in which there was maybe a half centimeter of rain. 80% of the trees survived. So that's really something. And that really speaks to how quickly we could change the whole underlying system. And when I say underlying system, I mean that literally, because he believes it's the fungal, the mycelial network that extends a plant's reach to get moisture and nutrients that was so robust that it allowed the trees to survive.
And when we think about the urgency of the ecological crisis that we face, the incredible speed with which regeneration can take place in the right political and economic environment, it just seems incredible that policymakers aren't listening to this more closely and aren't making the changes necessary to enable this regeneration to happen. Now, you've written a whole book called Cows Save the Planet. To you, just how important are cattle? And how can we persuade carbon-blinkered environmentalists that in the right systems, the cow's ecosystem engineering benefits more than outweigh their harms?
Well, how do you convince people? That's a very, very difficult question that I would say involves meeting people where they are and creating a situation where everybody's listening to each other, which is a hard kind of scenario, but it's not impossible. I've spent a lot of time trying to hone communication tools to deal with this very question. And one thing I would say is that to help people understand the role of grazing animals in particular kinds of landscapes. So Alan Savory developed what he calls the brittleness scale. Okay, so a brittle landscape, when you hear the places that I'm describing, it sounds like it's like desert or like how much rainfall a particular location gets, but it's about the distribution of rainfall. So a non-brittle landscape like the UK and like Vermont where I live gets moisture fairly evenly distributed throughout the year, whereas a place like Zimbabwe or South Africa gets all of its rain in a very short period of time. So as an example, my husband grew up in Johannesburg and then he moved to London. And he remembers Johannesburg as always sunny. And he remembers London as always rainy and, and drab. But as it turns out, they get about the same, these two places get about the same amount of rain. It's just that in Johannesburg, it's all in one period of time. So in a brittle landscape, nature was given a challenge, and that was how do you maintain moisture in the soil? And so that's so that it can sustain life, so life can be sustained from the end of one rainy season to the beginning of the next. And the answer, the solution that nature came up with was through the digestive system and behavior of ruminant animals. So moisture when it's not coming down from the sky, is held and transported via the animal. And the animal is bringing more, you know, is cycling moisture, it's cycling nutrients, it's cycling bacteria, which stimulates, it becomes part of the soil and stimulates the growth of plants. And so it's necessary. The cow's role, the cow as ecosystem engineer, its role and best use depends on the kind of landscape, and you manage according to the landscape you have. So in a non-brittle landscape, here in Vermont at Studio Hill, they have used sheep to regenerate their land. It was like, you know, pavement when they started in 2013, and now it has more bobolinks, which is a grassland bird, than the bobolink preserve farther north in the state. So the biodiversity is tremendous. It all depends on the situation and what you're managing for.
So it's a land first approach, very much, and it's something that we talk about on this podcast a lot. Is the idea that you look at the land, you listen to the land, you read the land, and then you use that land to produce the food that's appropriate in that landscape. Now, in your book, you've written about those raising farms from Earth that was once desert, and the Los Plateau in China is one of the most spectacular examples of regeneration. Could you just tell us a little about what happened there?
Yeah, the Los Plateau is a large region in China that was China's breadbasket. So agriculture developed there 10,000 years ago, around the same time as it did in the Fertile Crescent, and thousands of years of agricultural activity, which was sustained for a long time, but the land started to degrade and improper management of animals. So it was continuous grazing, which means just kind of leaving the animals to go where they want. And that is a surefire recipe for desertification, because some of the land will be overgrazed, or some of the plants will be overgrazed, and some will be undergrazed, so that you don't have enough animal impact in certain areas. So it's going to desertify there, and then it's going to be overly used and depleted where the animals had been lingering. So it was very bad shape. And the result was that several million people were living in poverty and couldn't sustain themselves. And the Yellow River kept silting up because the topsoil kept running into it. So it was a big mess. And the Chinese government looked at this situation and said, okay, we can continue to patch this up and, you know, give aid to the people and kind of just go down this road, but maybe more slowly. Or we can rehabilitate the landscape, the watersheds. They decided on the latter. They decided to do this project. So they organized biologists and physicists and hydrologists and geologists and economists, always economists, and they're all, you know, all kinds of experts, and they developed a plan, and then the World Bank picked it up and funded it, or created some of the funding, and they hired local people to restore the land, to create terraces, to do planting of appropriate vegetation, and including fruit-bearing trees. They also kept animals away from vulnerable spots. So that was a big piece of it. And the land started to revive in about, so John D. Liu is a filmmaker who documented this for the World Bank. And you can look at his videos. He has some wonderful videos that are time-lapsed. So in 8 seconds, you can watch what it took 14 years to accomplish, which is going from this brown, desiccated wasteland to a verdant, thriving region. This was done across a land area the size of Belgium, and the cost was 17 cents US per hectare per year. So this didn't cost much. And more than 2 million people were brought out of poverty. There were people, you can see this in John's films, that were living in caves. You know, the stories of grandmothers, you know, foregoing food and ultimately dying so that their grandchildren can live. I mean, you know, it was just horrendous, the kind of conditions that people endured. People were, you know, moving from place to place, hoping for a better situation. And often it was only marginally better. But now people are doing well, yeah, and are growing food and getting an education and all of it.
It's remarkable foresight. It's such a wonderful example of landscape scale recovery. And it's, you know, it's the kind of thing you only hope can happen in many other areas, for example, the Sahel and other places around the world. Now, we're coming towards the end of the program, and you've written that many people find it easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism. I wonder, is it capitalism in particular that's brought us to the brink of ecosystem collapse, or is the blame actually shared across all human socioeconomic structures?
Well, I know historians that talk about how all cultures have ultimately degraded their landscapes, regardless of their economic and ruling structures. So it's important to kind of keep that in mind. However, capitalism has created incentives for rapidly extracting wealth from the land and not replenishing it. So, yeah, capitalism has a lot to answer for. And I do see people asking really smart questions about how does capitalism serve us? If not, what might better serve us? What can we learn? And it's very tricky because, you know, a critique I have long held is that, you know, the sin was that not valuing what nature provides. But then again, putting a monetary figure on nature can lead us down lots of other roads that might not, you know, like you don't want to reduce nature to a commodity, like something you can trade on.
That was something I wanted to ask you about, because we talk a lot about natural capital through Farmgate and through through other conversations, not only in Britain, but around the world now, as ways of generating funding, of creating a market to be able to remove particular nutrients, for example, nitrogen or phosphorus, or we're all familiar with the idea of carbon trading. Do you think that capitalism can play any role in the regeneration of nature?
Wow, that's a big question. If I had the answer to that, I don't think I would be living, you know, in this little house on a mountain in Vermont. I would say very smart people around me do see a role for capitalism. I guess my answer is really need to keep our eyes open as to what paths different policies can lead us down, and that I believe there must be a place for valuing nature for its own sake, the integrity of biodiversity of all species and of all landscapes, and of that must be part of the part of the equation.
The integrity of the reindeer. I feel like we're starting to come full circle. Yes. But look, you've been so generous with your time. But just finally, you've written of beautiful and inspiring examples of human intervention helping to turn the tide on ecological degradation. Do you believe in your heart that we can address the ecological crisis at global scale, that we can relearn the value of nature, apply indigenous knowledge, and deliver that radical rebalancing with Earth's systems that's necessary in time to prevent disaster? Or is ecosystem collapse now just inevitable?
I would say that, first of all, both are happening. We have collapse and we have regeneration happening, often outside of the realm of the media and of public awareness. But I don't know. And I think it's important to own the fact that I don't know. When you don't know, first of all, that can be very scary. And one can strive, you know, to hold on to an answer. But in not knowing, you must do what you must do. You must do the right thing as if it were possible. I do believe it is possible to regenerate every ecosystem. And I do believe that the regeneration of ecosystems goes hand in hand with the regeneration of communities. And with the regeneration of communities, you get the regeneration of the individual who thrives when the land and the people around them are thriving. So, I mean, that's kind of where I sit, that this is the work. John D. Liu calls ecosystem restoration the great work of our time. And this is, you know, we're in the midst of the UN decade on ecosystem restoration. And I'm hearing about that more and more. So I believe that there's a lot of embracing of this and greater attention to it that I believe will continue.
Thank you so much. It's been such a fascinating conversation. I've learned so much talking to you. I'd like to thank my guest, Judith D. Schwartz. The Reindeer Chronicles is available from all good booksellers, and it's published by Chelsea Green. If you've enjoyed listening, please come back and listen to more. Tell your friends, like us, review us, and share our links. Farmgate is funded by Sankalpa. It's part of the 8.9 Hectares News Channel, and you can join the conversation on social media by searching for 8.9 HA. I've been Finlow Castain. Bye for now.